shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Mike. We're coming to you with another live Kingdom Concepts broadcast as we do the first Sunday of each month. We're being heard on WWCR 4.840 megahertz shortwave, WBCQ 7.415 megahertz shortwave. We have an internet streams from both of those stations, and you can also go to our website, kingidentity.com, kingidentity.com, and go to our radio page, and at the bottom you'll see our player directly from our studio, which has Winamp, Windows Media, etc., and that would be your clearest stream of tonight's program. Tonight we have a special guest calling us all the way from London, England. I know it's real early in the morning over there. I'd like to welcome to the broadcast Peter Rushton, the assistant editor of Heritage and Destiny magazine. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here, and a good evening to you and your listeners.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you, and really pleased that you got up so early in the morning. I believe it's about 4 a.m. over there to be on our program.
Exactly right, Mike. It's 4 a.m. here, yeah.
Well, I think you have some information that will be valuable to our listeners tonight. I know I've been a Christian patriot ever since my youth, that's what they call it in this country. And during that time, I've seen many charlatans, patriots for profits, those who compromise the truth when it's not politically correct, especially when it comes to racial matters or the Jewish problem, what we call kosher conservatives or neocons in this country. I know it's the same over there in the UK. What makes your organization different from some of the other so-called conservative political groups in the UK?
Sure. Well, there's in a sense two problems here in the UK. One of them is the tendency towards corrupt kosher conservatism, as you mentioned. The other, of course, is the legal situation, which we may mention a few times tonight, because the legal position over here, as in the rest of Europe, is that we don't have any guaranteed constitutional rights. So if we were to speak entirely frankly about racial matters, whether that's about the Jewish question or about other racial matters, we'd find ourselves in prison and our publications closed down. There are very, very strict laws in most European countries, and the UK is no exception. Putting the law on one side for the moment, the main political differences in the UK are between racial nationalists and other so-called nationalists who may call themselves civic nationalists, or who believe in nation with race, as you might say, which I always say is a bit like, if you believe in a nation without race, that's believing in a democracy without a demos. You know, when the ancient Greeks talked about democracy, they weren't talking about some vague notion of an all-comers democracy. They were talking about something rooted in the demos, rooted in what Germans would call the Volk, rooted in what we would call the race. If you want, certain political parties would want to throw that away. I support a party called the England First Party, which was rooted in the old British National Party, that believes that race and nation are inseparable. And our political tradition is to look towards an inseparable organic relationship between the people, between the race, and the nation. That's essentially the biggest difference.
Yeah, I noticed on your England First Party homepage it says faith, folk, and family, which, of course, nation
indeed,
is
sir.
Nationality or race. I completely forgot to give our toll-free call-in number to our listeners tonight, so let me give that right now. If any of our listeners would like to join the conversation tonight, you can dial 877-924-7722. That's a toll-free number, 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE. I'll also give you the opportunity here and also later in the program to give information where our listeners can contact you in case they would like to subscribe to Heritage and Destiny magazine or contact you for other reasons. Would you like to give that info?
I'm sorry, yes, I thought you were going to give that there. If you go to the Heritage and the England First Party website, is efp.org.uk, is the easiest way to contact us, or you can contact the Heritage and Destiny magazine by post at 40 Birkett Drive, that's B-I-R-K-E-T-T, Eston, Lancashire, if you're in Europe, or at PO Box 6501, Falls Church, Virginia, 22046, if you're in the USA, or by email at Heritage and Destiny, all one word with no dashes, heritageanddestiny@yahoo.com.
We've run ads in your publication for years, and recently had one ad censored. I think this happened once before. We were running an ad for the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, two different editions of that book, and about half of our ad was censored, and with the little note, this ad has been censored by UK race laws. And like I said, that happened once before. And, of course, it deals with the Jewish problem, but the ad itself did not mention the word Jew at all. It did mention race, but I guess there's some pretty strong laws over there that most U.S. people are not aware of.
Yeah, well, Mike, it's a great irony, of course, that this should be dealing with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an irony on two counts. First of all, that in the early 1920s, publications here in London were among the first publications to draw attention to the Protocols. Mainstream newspapers wrote about the Jewish question in those days. Over the last 40-odd years, there's been a steady tightening of the legal position, so much so that they don't even have to allege intent. They don't have to charge you with intent to incite racial hatred. It can simply be that, in the words of the law, having regard to all the circumstances, racial hatred was likely to be stirred up. And that's one of the headings of the UK law. The other heading that must be satisfied, nation must be deemed threatening, abusive, or insulting. In other words, it doesn't have to be an incitement to violence or an incitement to any form of crime. Simply that it's threatening, abusive, or insulting, and that it's either intended or simply having regard to all the circumstances, racial hatred is likely to be stirred up. Now, of course, here in the UK, that might sound bad enough. In some parts of Europe, the laws are even worse, such as in Germany, where some friends of mine were in Germany just a few days ago, protesting outside a prison in Germany where a man is serving a 12-year prison sentence for offences against the German equivalent of this law, this Section 130 under the German law, which bans any reference to the so-called theories of Holocaust revisionism, bans any debate, any questioning of the 6 million figure of the Holocaust. And as some of your listeners may well know, several people have gone to prison over the years. The man who was in prison in Brandenburg, whose fate launched this demonstration, serving this 12-year sentence, is himself a German lawyer, Horst Mahler, but serving a 12-year prison sentence. Another German lawyer, Sylvia Stoltz, is also in prison, is scheduled to be released from prison next week. So in many parts of Europe, they're even worse. They have even worse laws than us here in the UK. But
now you can still question the so-called Holocaust there in Great Britain, is that correct?
There's no law specifically relating to the Holocaust. If they wanted to prosecute you here, they would have to say that that what you'd written about the Holocaust was likely to stir up racial hatred. Now, if they were to try to tighten prosecution against Holocaust revisionists here, they would have to do it probably under a reinterpretation of that law rather than a completely new law.
I've heard in the news recently that a Christian couple couldn't even adopt a child because they taught that homosexuality is wrong, which, of course, Christianity teaches. And I've also heard in the news that the state is going around giving contraceptive teachings and distributing condoms, even in private Christian schools, which, of course, is encouraging promiscuity. And how did Great Britain get this far where such draconian laws have been passed?
Well, I think it some people would say that it starts off with the decline of traditional religion in the UK, which really dates back. There's been a steady decline for about a century in traditional religion and an undermining of our institutions. There's been as well as a legal war, there's been, if you like, a cultural war, and that cultural war intensified in the 1960s. You may know that Marxists, having moved away from the class war rhetoric of socialism, many people on the left, including many Jews on the left, had a cultural strategy of a long march through the institutions here, through institutions like the BBC, through political parties. And that cultural war took over, if you like, from the traditional Marxist economic war quite a long time ago. In the 1960s, a number of laws, alongside the law that I mentioned on racial hatred, banning so-called racial hatred, a number of laws were brought in to protect the rights of other minorities like homosexuals, as you say. People forget that until 40-odd years ago, homosexuality was a criminal offense, and it's now something that's very, very widely promoted as part of an attack on traditional values. As you say, schools are the front line of a lot of this in the attack on traditional morality. And
I was surprised that they could even get into private Christian schools. You know, in this country, they pull a lot of that stuff too, but it's in the public government schools.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's been an extension of both the law and of various regulatory measures right across the board educationally. And it's in private schools, it's not quite so bad, but it's almost as bad here. There are a few exemptions for private schools, but for the most part, you have to sign up to all of the political correctness. You have to bow to all of the politically correct nostrums. Certainly, if you want to get public funding, it's particularly bad. But right across the board now, where homosexuality, where traditional morality is concerned, you're expected to sign up to the politically correct approach.
Well, I know that in this country, we're heading the same direction in a lot of ways. A lot of it comes through regulatory agencies, but then some of it comes directly from the Congress, the type men we're voting in. What type of people are they voting in? Are they actually passing these laws in the UK Parliament?
Oh, yes. Well, when it started in the 1960s, there would have been quite a number of people that would have opposed those laws. But and many of these came in on what would be termed a free vote in the House of Commons. People were not whipped into a party line on these votes. But steadily since then, it would now be, I would say, it's certainly impossible in the Labour Party and impossible in the majority of the in any of the three major parties now. It would be impossible to get a nomination to stand for Parliament for Labour, Conservative, or the Liberal Democrats, which are the three parties here, the three major parties, if you didn't toe the line on those social issues, you know, on these those politically correct issues. You simply wouldn't become a candidate. And if it, even if it were found that you had ever in your life made a speech or written an article that questioned those attitudes, there would be an outrage within those parties, and you'd be forced to resign as a candidate. It would be 10 years ago, even one or two people in the Conservative Party with more traditional views could have got elected, could have become a candidate. But since the present Prime Minister became leader of the Conservative Party, they've become even more blatantly politically correct on a whole range of issues. So until the collapse of the party system now, where the major parties are concerned, there's no hope on those questions.
I assume you have Jewish control of the media, the major media, just like we do in this country, which, of course,
yes,
tries to brainwash the public.
Yes, that's been the case for quite a number of years. That's even outside of the criminal law regarding the issues I mentioned earlier. There's a much wider problem in institutions such as the BBC. The Jewish presence at the top of the BBC and at the top of many sections of the media is very, very evident. Now, within Jewry, there are one or two Jews who would adopt a self-consciously conservative position on moral issues. But the cutting edge of much of the politically correct movement over the past 40 years has been of liberal Jewry, yeah. There's no question about that.
I know that compared to the media in this country, the BBC is actually rather professional, but I've had a few contacts from British reporters, maybe freelance, and they seem to be pushing an agenda even worse than the reporters in this country. I know that one, Nick Ryan, who came over here, presented himself as being fair, but then when I read what he wrote, it was just total lies and distortions of what I had said. And I was shocked that he was even worse than those in this country.
Oh yeah, yeah. I met Mr. Ryan in London myself on one occasion. Yeah, and he's an example of the type of journalist who appears to be reasonable on the surface. He isn't sort of frothing at the mouth with outrage at everything that we might say, but he has a longer term agenda to write things in a certain way that will undermine us in a more subtle manner. Unlike some of the mainstream journalists who would just not write about us at all. So you've got to be careful with any mainstream journalist you encounter, I'm afraid. There's not a lot of fair treatment about as far as people of our point of view are concerned.
He was working with the Southern Poverty Law Center in this country, which is a left-wing Jewish organization. Let me give our toll-free number out to our audience again. If you would like to join the conversation tonight and ask Mr. Rushton any questions about the situation in the UK and Europe, we'd welcome your call. It's toll-free, 877-924-7722. 877-924-7722. You mentioned the Conservative Party, the way it was going, and of course, the Liberal or Labour Party over there. But the British National Party has gone downhill. I know that under John Tyndale, he took a no-compromise stand as far as preserving racial integrity. What has happened to the British National Party, which, you know, looks good in the eyes of many, but I understand that it's actually rather deceitful when it comes to the reality of the situation?
Well, it's been a very sad tale with the British National Party. I think we have to draw a distinction between the ordinary members and activists of that party, which include many, many very good people, and a small group of people in the leadership of that party who took over the party in 1999 when the current party chairman, Nick Griffin, ousted John Tyndall, as you mentioned. And John Tyndall, of course, is a good friend of mine, and sadly he died in 2005. But before that, he'd been ousted in an internal coup in 1999 by Nick Griffin. And many people at first thought Nick Griffin was going to do a good job, that he was going to take the party forward in certain technical modernizations without selling out principle. But the saga of Nick Griffin's leadership has been a fundamental selling out of principle, and perhaps even worse, what's become clear in the last 6 months is the extent of the financial corruption at the heart of the BNP, and I don't use those words lightly. The BNP now finds itself crippled by what looks to be over £500,000 of debt, including legal fees. And I think we'll see those issues are now coming to a head in the courts and in various civil actions, and represent the crippling of what was once a very strong and very hopeful movement. We can only hope that as that process comes to a head, something can come out of the ashes of the BNP, that the many good people inside the BNP still are able to come together again without faction or rancor, and that we're able to move forward for the sake of our people, because, you know, time's pretty short if we're going to save the indigenous British people, if we're going to stand up for the rights of white people worldwide. Time's pretty short now. We can't afford to continue for too long.
Hello? Hopefully we'll get our guests back in a minute. I'll invite you to call tonight. Sometimes people call right at the end of the program and we can't get their question answered. We run out of time or we can't answer it adequately. So I'd invite our listeners to call 877-924-7722. That's 877-924-7722, 877-YAWS-RACE, and participate in tonight's program. Our guest tonight, which we hopefully will have back in a minute, is Peter Rushton, the assistant editor of Heritage and Destiny magazine. He's also affiliated with the England First Party over in Great Britain. He's familiar with the situation in the UK and in Europe, preserving the racial nationalism over there. And, of course, it's a long ways over there, and we did have some problems on the phone. We hope to have him back in a minute.
I'm back on there, Mike. That's fine.
Okay, great. I'm glad that you're back. Go ahead. We'll pick up where you left off.
Yeah, I was just saying we're hoping, in fact, that the BNP or that British nationalism will be able to pick up where we left off as well, because the sad situation with the BNP is that under Nick Griffin's leadership, particularly over the last year or two, the party financially has been wrecked, pretty much I think now beyond repair, and those of us who had left the BNP at various stages in despair at Griffin's leadership, whether in terms of political principle or in terms of organisation and finance, are now looking at a position where we've got to look forward and build a renewed movement out of the ashes of the BNP. There are hopeful signs, because so many of the activists inside that party are still people of goodwill, who I think will be able to come together and build something positive out of the collapse of that party.
It's my understanding that they even have some Pakistanis and Jews in the party that are taking positions of leadership and running for office, which seems rather outrageous. Is that true?
Well, yeah, the BNP has had a Jewish councillor for a year or two in the south of England, and there's been a move, partly forced by the courts, to admit non-white members. This was partly a measure that was talked about politically by Nick Griffin for several years, but then, in any case, aside of internal party discussions, the courts now said that that political parties must accept non-white members. They haven't said they must. They haven't yet said they must have non-white candidates for office, but they've said that political parties are not allowed to restrict their membership on ethnic grounds. Now, that's a relatively new legal judgment. It's a judgment that may be subject to review and to appeal, but that's the state of the law at present.
That's a lot of our problem in this country is the court system. I see we have a caller on line 3, Jonathan from Ottawa, Canada. You're on the air.
To hear both you gentlemen. Yes, I'm calling. I'm with a biblical creation science group here in Canada. And the same problems that you were mentioning in your areas, those same problems are also occurring in this country. And so what I would like to ask, as well as make a comment, that there seems to be a backlash forming, a good Christian backlash, that many of the of good Christian people are starting to stand up and speak out for good biblical Christian family values. And in fact, we even have a pro-conservative government right now in Canada that seems to be rising in popularity. What hope do you see for such a thing in England and the United States?
Peter, you want to take that first?
Yeah, well, from my point of view, the biggest problem with that here in the UK and in several other countries in Europe is that so many of those Christian activists are infected by the virus, if you like, of Christian Zionism. I'm sure that must be the case in the USA and Canada as well, to an extent. But here in the UK, that's a particularly serious problem, with so many of the people who campaign on Christian issues and who focus their attention, particularly those who focus their attention on Islam, but also those who focus their attention on traditional morality, are still at the same time infected by Christian Zionism. And while that's the case, there's clearly going to be no political progress down that route. So I think what I hope is that a section of traditional Christianity will be able to fight back against that Christian Zionist virus.
Yes, but don't you think that that we should focus on biblical family and moral values, even though we may have a certain dissent, you know, on some political issues? We must get the brotherhood together and stand on those biblical values that are being attacked by, you know, evil, ungodly forces in the liberal movement, the socialist movement, and so on, that are damaging, you know, our society and Christian values. So don't you think we should just concentrate on that and, you know, and let the brothers decide about Israel and Islam? Personally, I myself think that Islam is one of the greatest threats to the world today. It is false religion, and Israel, even though Israel is not Christian, they are the only democracy in the Middle East. But as far as that's concerned, in our country, our morals are being eroded. We are being attacked, and we should be standing up for and standing first for those moral values, those life and death issues that are destroying our families and our children today.
I certainly agree that we need to stand up on moral issues and we need to stand together on moral issues. But surely there's no greater moral issue than fighting an illegal and immoral war and sending your own people to fight and die in an illegal and immoral war, as happened in 2003, and as no doubt the neocons will plan for us to do again. So it's very, very difficult to stand together on moral issues with neocon or neocon-influenced people or Christian Zionist-influenced people who are wanting to go so far as to commit one's own country to an illegal and immoral war. There can be no bigger life or death issue than that, especially for anyone who has friends and family in the armed forces who might be sent to carry out such a war. So at present, that is always going to be a pretty insuperable obstacle if certain Christians are going to go so far as to aggressively support such an illegal and immoral conflict.
Well, you and I would certainly agree on this Libya situation, because here this crazy situation in Libya is Muslim killing Muslim, Muslim oppressing Muslim, and we have no business being there. If they want some air support over there, then why doesn't the Arab League get together and do their own thing? They should not be asking us Christians to come in and take sides on what is an evil Muslim conflict. Would you agree with that?
I agree with you 100% on that, but I think one of our great campaigning issues, and certainly here in the England First Party, we've been doing election leaflets recently to stress the wasteful nature, the criminally wasteful nature of military involvement in Libya at present, where £500,000 is spent on each of these Tomahawk cruise missiles being fired in by the Royal Navy, not to mention the cost of the rest of that military adventure, at a time when basic services are being cut back. This is an issue on which both the criminal foreign policy and morally criminal and degenerate domestic policies could be brought together on campaigning issues to say, look at what taxpayers' money is being spent on, a criminal foreign adventure, and domestically, not the bolstering of our society, but state funds being spent on things that undermine our society. So our morality is undermined both by our foreign policy and by our domestic policies. This should be a powerful call that should be going out from all wings of our movement to make it clear to the British people, the Canadian people, the American people, just what is being done in our name.
Unfortunately, the ones pushing this a lot are the churches, the so-called Christian churches, who have the Zionist-type teachings, as you said, and the kosher conservatives in the media who are pushing this. I think a lot of times, naturally, the Muslim religion or the Muslim religion is an incorrect religion, it's a false religion, but I think they whip our people up against them to serve the purposes of the Jews or so-called Jews over there in Israel. And they push an agenda that's actually, when they criticize many of the Sharia laws, for instance, they're actually criticizing some of our own biblical laws. So I think the people are being used by the media. And it is a racial issue. I know we teach that the true Israel of the Bible are the white Anglo-Saxon and Germanic peoples, which most of the churches do not teach, and it's a fundamental error. And I think we need to correct this teaching. And in order to change anything, we first need to change the hearts of the people we can have any political change. And I'd like to make one other comment that Jonathan made. We don't all have the same calling. You know, I do teach from a biblical standpoint God's laws and the racial makeup of our people, the identification of true Israel, but not everybody is in the position of a priest. There are some in the position of the leadership, the king's role, and there's some in the, you know, in the military type leadership, and there's different callings within the body, but biblically, they all work together as a whole. And so,
fine.
Pardon?
God bless you. God bless you. In fact, our group here, I'm with the Biblical Cosmology and Prophecy Group, and our group specifically examines the prophecies of the Bible, and so we agree with you folks that that what is happening in the world today is a strong indication that we are in that generation that Jesus Christ is going to return in, and we've got to stick to very closely to biblical principles, especially when it comes to morals and political action and so on. So I certainly do bless your actions and your studies in these areas.
And I thank you for your call, Jonathan. We appreciate you calling tonight. And we'd invite others to call 877-924-7722. And do you have any further comments on what he had to say, Peter?
Well, I think in relation to this issue of Islam that you mentioned, I can't see that that Islam would present any threat to the peoples of the West if the peoples of the West had their own still had their own strong religious and moral commitments. There would be many areas of Islam that would, of course, be similar, as you say, in terms of their laws to Christian laws. So many of the problems are not so much with an invading force. Some people in our movement suggest our problem is an Islamic invasion. That's at the core of our difficulties. I would have thought the difficulty rather is that our own religious and moral foundations have been sapped and undermined, in fact, long before any substantial numbers of Muslims arrived in the UK or in other parts of Europe.
I know that over in France they've outlawed the veil, and in Switzerland they outlawed what they call minarets, basically taking away people's freedom instead of getting to the real core of the issue, and that's a racial problem, that white countries with a Christian tradition shouldn't be letting non-whites from Turkey and Pakistan and some of these other places in there. Why don't they get to the core of the issue instead of taking away rights from the people and going around the edges?
Well, of course, because they don't want to address the core of the issue, because many of these people who make a great fuss about solely about Islam are actually in favor of mass immigration, either for economic reasons or for social reasons, sometimes for both. In the case of the UK, they like to have mass immigration so as to hold down wages as a source of cheap labor in the UK. And also, of course, they like to have mass immigration so as to divide and undermine the will of the indigenous population. So it's as I say, it's not an issue of Islam from my point of view. It's a much longer term and much bigger issue than religious division. It's a matter of fundamental racial division as well, and an undermining of British culture going back many decades.
It's impossible not to change the culture when you don't have the race the same. I know we have in this problem an invasion of the Mexicans. You have an invasion of Pakistanis, and there's various other places in the world that have various racial problems. And regardless of what you consider the differences, a person has to admit that the culture is going to be changed.
Well, yes. In particular, certainly in the UK, mass immigration affected certain towns and cities far more than it did others. So when you look at the overall immigration statistics, this disguises the fact that in certain towns and cities, for example, in the heartland of what was once the heartland of British industry in Lancashire in the northwest of England, there was a tremendous flood of immigration into those factory towns, which has totally changed the character of those towns. So if you were somebody brought up in a white Briton brought up in those towns, you faced a double attack. You faced the undermining of the economy, and you faced the undermining of society by this influx of people whose customs, whose race, everything about them was completely alien to you. So it breaks down those cultural bonds, those societal bonds at the most basic level. And certain towns and cities have seen their character completely transformed in the space of a generation or two over here. It really has been the most cataclysmic development for large parts of the UK. And at the same time as this was happening, laws were being tightened to prevent us speaking and writing about it. So it really is a pretty devilish development.
It's similar to the Mexican invasion in this country. We have a caller who wishes to remain anonymous on line four. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I have many points I'd like to mention in passing so that the distinguished guests can comment on them after I jump off the line. I myself am part British and provably about to couple of generations, but I certainly wouldn't purport to tell you how to run your affairs in England. I think you're drifting as a country, as a nation, off into a kind of spiritual no man's land, which is not entirely in your favor with God or man. But sometimes I feel like while I have a great deal of respect for my British ancestors and our forefathers in many ways that helped found this country, at the same time, hearing from some of the British in the sort of upper classes, I feel like they expect me to be Pip in a Dickens novel and not give them very much credit for intelligence. Now, there are some distinguished political figures in your history that very underappreciated. One of those is Winston Churchill, and I know him more as an author of a very excellent history of England, which is in some libraries, I'm sure, and he has many complex points to make about very scholarly documented, very well documented history of World War II as well, but there's a lot of scholarship in that, and I don't know exactly how many Jewish persons were persecuted and in what ways, but the numbers are hardly as important as what happened, and that a very bad guy made it happen. That's one, Adolf Hitler. Secondly, I wondered if you'd ever heard of Dr. Gene Scott, now deceased, based in Los Angeles, California, and another very scholarly guy with Bible scholarship just up to his ears, and very carefully and painstakingly researched the travels of Israel, the people of Israel, all 12 tribes of Israel, to England and other places. And if people would go into that, they would see that an unknown percentage of the people now calling themselves Jews, which derives from the tribe of Yehuda, are actually from that tribe, and another unknown percentage may very well not be. And I doubt if we ourselves know that exact percentage or exactly who's who. And here's an additional point I'd like you to bring up. Every time you mention, and this is based on scholarly lectures that I've carefully listened to, and when you mention in very, very general terms, and I say this not to be in any way remotely intellectually provocative or, not trying to be supportive nor particularly contentious, but the word Ishmael comes to mind and his characteristics. But that's just a very broad generalization, and I think we all run this risk of a significant amount of oversimplification when it comes to the complex marriages and migrations of persons over time in this regard. So I'm going to let loose and let you talk. Bye.
I am familiar with Dr. Gene Scott. I do know that Ray Kapp, prior to his death, told me that Gene Scott distributed a lot of his movies, which we also carry a lot of his videos, but Gene Scott did teach a message that was similar to what we teach and distributed a lot of Ray Kapp's movies. And I'll let Peter comment.
Uh-huh. I think it's certainly a very interesting question as to how many of the people who are referred to as Jews today are actually identical to the Jews of thousands of years ago. A number of books have addressed this topic. Even in Israel itself, I understand, an Israeli scholar, Shlomo Sand, wrote a book recently about the invention of the Jewish people. He picking up on a story that was written decades ago by another man of Jewish origin, Arthur Koestler, in the 13th tribe. So there have been various people who've addressed some of these issues over the years, and the question of whether Jews are Jews. And this is one route, of course, that undermines the whole Christian Zionist angle. Now, it could be said, though, that from a political rather than a religious point of view, whether the Jews were biologically the same people who were there 2,000 years ago is almost immaterial to the politics of 1948 when the modern-day state of Israel was created. Because whoever those people were over tracing through the generations over 2,000 years, it was surely no business of Britain or America to seek to support the piracy of Palestine by these people returning to Palestine after 2,000 years, or whether they'd in fact never been there at all and were in fact of Khazar ancestry. It was still no business of ours to be supporting that piracy. And in fact, it was undermining the British and American interests across the region.
And during World War One, when Colonel Lawrence was, Lawrence of Arabia, they were our friends. And, since then, since the sellout of the Balfour Declaration, the Arab peoples have basically become our enemies. I see we have a caller on line two. Let's take the caller on line two. Annette on line two.
Good evening, gentlemen. I am a Christian Israel believer, and Mr. Hallimore knows that I have followed his Kingdom Identity ministry. I heard a gentleman who called in declaring that the Israeli state is a democracy. But if you look into their policies and practices, they are nothing like a democracy. They are a dictatorship. And what is so obvious to many people now is that in world Jewry, you have a situation where even the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, made the statement on October 3rd, 2001, "We, the Jewish people," I'm quoting now, "we, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it." That was made on October 3rd, 2001. Now, the gentleman also mentioned Hitler, and evidently he believes in a Holocaust. I have some information from the 1934 and the 1945 World Almanac and the Book of Facts. And may I quote the figures regarding that so-called 6 million Jewish loss in Germany?
Go ahead.
All right. It's by the American Jewish Committee and the Jewish Statistical Bureau of the Synagogue Council of America. H.S. Linfield is the director. Here are the statistics. In the 1934 Almanac, when Hitler took power, there were 15,630,000 Jews. In the 1945 almanac, when Hitler left power, there were alive 15,688,259 Jews alive. That is a 58,000 plus increase, not minus 6 million. And I thought it would be good to bring that out at this point.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate your call. I agree with what you said. Peter, do you have any comments?
Yes, I think I was very grateful for that, for those observations, because Bear in mind, your listeners should bear in mind that the latter part of what was said in that call to make those statistical arguments would be illegal in many parts of Europe, and if you were accused of Holocaust denial in Germany, for example, your defense lawyer would not be allowed to bring those factual arguments into court in your defense. And if they persisted in trying to do so, your defense lawyer could, him or herself, be prosecuted. That's the state of affairs in Europe today. And I'd simply ask people to think, what type of historical truth is it that requires the criminal law to protect it and requires the criminal law to prosecute those who question it? It might also be worth bearing in mind that in America, one of the earliest propagandists on this Holocaust issue during the 1940s was Peter Bergson, also known as Hillel Cook, who was the very same man who was running the support network in the USA for the Jewish terrorist organization, the Zionist terrorist organization, the Irgun. So when this connects these two aspects of the story, because if people want to call Israel a democracy, they need to bear in mind that right from the very start, that state was based on the forced expulsion of most of the indigenous population. And for example, with the massacre at Deir Yassin, people can look up the facts of this matter for themselves. There are a number of websites about the facts of what happened at the village of Deir Yassin as one particular extreme example of where this Zionist terrorist force, the Irgun, acted as the spearhead of Zionism, slaughtering Palestinians, setting an example of terror that would lead other Palestinians to flee their homes.
I believe he's dropped off the line. I'd invite you to listen to our broadcast again on the archives, and you can pick up the information that he gave earlier. I'd like to thank Peter for being our guest tonight, and our contact information will come up here in a second. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.